Good evening. Tonight we will hear oral argument in the case of United States versus Gallagher. This is not a moot court or a mock trial. This is a real case and a real appellate hearing. Therefore, I would remind everyone to make sure your cell phones and pagers are turned off so we avoid any interruptions during the hearing. The way this will operate is each side has been allotted 20 minutes to argue. Appellant will argue first. They have reserved 4 minutes for rebuttal. Following the appellant's initial argument, amicus curiae, Mr. Kusky, will argue second. He has been allotted 10 minutes. Following him, the government will argue third for 20 minutes, and then appellant will argue last for their final 4 minutes of rebuttal. Following the argument, the judges will remain in place after we've gaveled the hearing to a close, and they will hold a question and answer session. If you have any questions for the court, not about this case, because that will be under submission, but any questions about the court, its jurisdiction, its practice, anything like that, in the backgrounds of the judges, so on, they'll be happy to answer those. In the our court brochures are the biographies of the judges for your review, and you can look at those. And in the school's pamphlet is a summary of the case that we have for tonight. Are there any questions before we get started? Okay, it looks like we got some more people coming in. Come on in. Chief Judge and the Associate Judges of the United States Court of Appeals for the Armed Forces. Hear ye, hear ye, hear ye. The Honorable United States Court of Appeals for the Armed Forces is now open and in session. God save the United States of America and this Honorable Court. Please be seated.
Good evening. Today, the George Mason School of Law has been transformed into a federal courthouse. We are grateful to Dean Polsby, the staff of the law school, and the members of the George Mason Inn of Court for their thoughtful and careful planning in making the arrangements for our visit. We welcome students and faculty, members of the bar, men and women of the armed forces, and the public to these proceedings. We shall now proceed to the oral argument in United States against Gallagher. We shall hear first from counsel for the appellant. Counsel, you may proceed.
Good evening, Your Honor. Judge Efron, member of the court,
pleasure to see you all again. Members of the court, to put it succinctly, the military judge abused his discretion by denying the defense motion to suppress the evidence found in the appellant's briefcase and on his computer. As such, this court should reverse the appellant's conviction. Members of the court, what the appellant will do during this argument is to start with a very simple premise, and that premise, which has been articulated by several circuit courts and in some degree the Supreme Court, is this: briefcases are different. Briefcases are different. How do we know that briefcases are different? Well, several circuit courts have addressed that issue. In United States versus Frere, the Court of Appeals stated that few places outside of the home justify a greater expectation of privacy than does a briefcase, and goes on to quote, worse to the extent of, it is an extension of one's own clothing. Nearly every circuit that has addressed this issue.
How did the Frere court end up ruling in that case?
In that course, Your Honor, they applied the automobile exception because of the recent case of United States versus Ross, and they did uphold the search, but they did say, that briefcases are different.
And then went ahead and upheld the search.
They upheld the search because of the automobile exception. In the case of United States versus Baczynski, the issue dealt with a locked briefcase inside of a friend's barn. In that case, the court overturned the results of the search.
Was this briefcase locked?
This briefcase was locked. It was, Your Honor, and which is a distinction that we will address in a few minutes.
Does it make any difference if there's any identifying marks on the briefcase, a tag that says this belongs to so-and-so, or is that different than a briefcase that has no distinguishing marks on it at all?
In the case at bar, Your Honor, we argue that it does not make any difference because, as we will discuss later, there is only one reasonable conclusion that the police officers could have come to as it relates to the ownership of the briefcase.
Well, I'd like you to explain that because I've seen a lot of women with briefcases, and I find your argument that only a man or other professional would have a briefcase to be a little bit disturbing.
It is not gender, Your Honor, and the government counsel makes much of the fact that we are making a gender distinction. We are not. We are making an employment distinction. If Gunny Sergeant Gallagher were the female Gunny Sergeant Gallagher, and if Mr. Gallagher was a part-time retail clerk, the results in this case would still be the same. It is not a gender-related issue at all. It is an issue of according a briefcase the due deference that other circuit courts that have approached this issue have accorded it.
And what does the record state about the occupation of Mrs. Gallagher?
Very little, if anything. It is.
Must say something.
Well, it says, I mean, we know that she is a retail clerk, that she worked in a Blockbuster store, that she was a part-time manager, and otherwise was just a regular clerk. It is unclear.
So why would it be unreasonable for someone who is a manager of a retail store to have a briefcase in which that person, he or she, would bring home work related to the management of that activity?
Because there would be no, at a very minimum, Your Honor, it would be incumbent upon the police officers to adopt the policy that the amicus will, but under the facts of this case, there was no reasonable belief. In fact, there was very little evidence, if any, that the police officers even knew what her occupation was. In fact, the NIS agents never say that they knew what it is that she did for a living.
Did the military judge know?
Certainly the military judge knew at that point.
And could the military judge take that into account in reaching the conclusion reached in this case?
Well, he could not, Your Honor, because what you have to go with is what did the reasonable person know with the information that they had at the time of the search, not at the time of a suppression hearing months later.
Can you go through the judge's findings and tell us what's clearly erroneous and where he got the law wrong?
He got the law wrong.
Cite the paragraph in the sentence.
I can certainly do that. I don't have it right now, Judge. I mean, I can certainly do it during my rebuttal period, and I will show you which sentence.
Well, isn't that what you're trying to argue here today, that the judge got it wrong?
The judge's conclusions of law are erroneous, Your Honor.
Well, so which ones? Aren't we looking at that?
His conclusion of law that the police officers had no reason to know to whom that briefcase belonged, and his conclusion
which
of law.
Which paragraph are you in, and what exactly is incorrect about it?
The lower court below used two standards used the Bustamante standard. Actually, that's the correct standard, looking at the totality of the circumstances. But in paragraph 3, the military judge looks at several factors and leads to paragraph 4. And he says, based upon the facts of this case, the court concludes that the government has shown by clear and convincing evidence that Mrs. Gallagher freely gave consent to the search. That is correct to the home. However, the fact that the military judge extended that to the search of the briefcase, which he clearly did, is what the appellant argues was clearly erroneous, and that he was wrong as to the law by failing to follow the standards set out in Salinas Cano and Welch, which is a purse case, and Frere, which is the automobile exception, and by the Supreme Court case of Florida versus Jimeno, where the military judge erred, Your Honor, was by failing to draw a distinction between containers in a home and a briefcase. And nearly every circuit court that has addressed this issue has said briefcases are different. And the Supreme Court in Florida versus Jimeno says it is very likely unreasonable to think that a suspect, by consenting to the search of his trunk of his car, has agreed to breaking open of a locked briefcase within the trunk. Why is that? Why are briefcases different? And you're right, Judge Stuckey. In that case, again, the briefcase was locked, and we're going to discuss that in a second. Why are briefcases different? Briefcases are different because, as the courts have said over and over again, they are basically a little home. They are, as the court in Frere said, the depository of most of a person's deeply personal items. They are akin to pockets on a pair of pants. And certainly if a spouse gives consent to search a house, it would not include the husband's pants pockets. Why? Because she does not control those pants pockets. Similarly, as we note in our brief, if the appellant walked in with his duffel bag, obviously a green duffel bag, I would assume the Marines use, same as the Army, drops in and drops a duffel bag. Whether or not it is locked is not going to be the incumbent issue. The issue is whether or not the police officers had a reasonable belief that either A, Mrs. Gallagher had joint control or had exclusive control over the briefcase, which they did not have reason to believe, or two, that there
Why
was some sort of joint control.
Why didn't they have reason to
believe it was joint control? Because they didn't
ask. How were they supposed to know it was his briefcase?
They could have asked. A very simple question to Mrs. Gallagher, as amicus argues.
But she had given them consent to search.
She had given them consent to search an entire house.
And she didn't limit that consent.
She did not, but...
And they made it clear what they were searching for.
That is correct, Your Honor.
However... Including papers, and where do you store papers?
Well, the NIS agent said very specifically that if that briefcase had been locked, we would not have gone into it, in spite of this all-expansive search. So clearly the NIS agents knew that there were some limitations based upon the scope of their search authorization.
Which way does that cut?
Well, I think
if they knew there were limits, they searched it anyway. Wasn't that a reasonable belief?
They said that they had no reason. Are you speaking in terms of probable cause, Your Honor?
No, I'm not speaking in terms. I'm speaking in terms of their reasonable expectations, given the fact that she had given a blanket authorization to search the house, and the briefcase was in the house.
And upon coming upon that briefcase, all of the courts have said that, in fact, I will give you the quote from, there are two cases that are cited in our brief, the Whitfield case and the Fultz case. The government must provide compelling evidence of both shared use and joint access of a container to support third-party consent. In this case, the
Was
government
that a
had neither.
Container?
Whitfield... I would have to check to be 100% sure. I do not believe Whitfield was a locked case. I know that Fultz was not. Fultz was cardboard boxes in a garage. That's a Ninth Circuit case in which there were cardboard boxes in a garage that were closed but not locked, and the holding was that there was an increased expectation of privacy in private storage matters, and therefore a third party's consent to search the garage did not go to the cardboard boxes within the garage.
Who is the third party in that
The third
case?
Party was the person who owned the house, and Mr. Fultz had deposited boxes in her house. And the Ninth Circuit in that court said that that does not extend to containers within a garage. And in that case, one of the prevailing factors, Your Honor, which is directly analogous to this case, is that Mr. Fultz was essentially homeless at the time. And the court said that's akin to his living space. Well, the courts have also said that a briefcase is akin to where one puts the most private matters of their lives.
But in this case, we're not really talking about a garage as we normally think of a garage. Here we're talking about a garage that's kind of been turned into a family room. They use it for recreation. They have a set up bar there. The TV's there. The toys are there. The kids are in there. Everyone in the family has access to it, and we have this container that's not locked, sitting on the floor in plain sight. Now, why would a law enforcement agent who saw that think anything, that there could be any heightened interest of privacy in that when it could be full of kids' toys or blocks or anything?
Because the law tells them to. Because the law tells them that briefcases are different and that they have an extra obligation when it comes to briefcases. And therefore, if it were a toy box, Your Honor, certainly you open up a toy box. If it were even, I would even grant you that maybe under the facts of this case, if it were the cardboard box that it was in Fultz, the result might be different because they're cardboard boxes in a garage that is being used as a quasi-family room. But all of the cases that discuss this issue specifically note that briefcases are different. Therefore, it is incumbent upon police officers to do more than what they did in this case, and certainly the fact that the NIS agent says, oh, if it had been locked, we would have not gone into it,
so
supports that argument.
Are you arguing the amicus argument that when they run into a situation that's a little ambiguous, that they have a duty then to ask?
Certainly, if this court wishes to adopt the amicus standard, we would not disagree with the court, and we think that it would be extremely helpful for future cases. It is not necessary to resolve the facts of this case, because the facts of this case support that no reasonable police officer could have assumed that Mrs. Gallagher had either exclusive use of the briefcase or shared use of the briefcase.
What about apparent authority?
In what sense, Your Honor?
Well, she's in the house, that, just like Judge Erdman said, the briefcase is lying out there in the open. And why wasn't it reasonable for the law enforcement officers to think it was her briefcase or she had authority to allow access to it?
Because at the time of the search, Your Honor, they knew two things that are very important in this case. One is they knew that Gunny Gallagher was a personnel specialist with the United States Marine Corps. They also knew that Mrs. Gallagher had some sort of a job. They did not know what that job was. All that they knew is that when they showed up, she said, I have to be to work in a little bit. Clearly, she was not dressed in business attire. The record supports that. So as between the two individuals, the only reasonable conclusion would be, this is Gunny Gallagher's briefcase.
So your case hinges on one's perception of male and female roles and who carries briefcases, back to Judge Ryan's question?
It hinges on, and again, Your Honor, just so the court is clear, if they had shown
or on
up,
on the reasonable belief that all gunnery sergeants in the Marine Corps carry briefcases?
Certainly not all gunnery sergeants. Okay. Therefore, the facts, and as I explained to Judge Ryan,
or the people who dress sloppily at work don't carry briefcases?
As I explained to Judge Ryan, Your Honor, if the court had shown up, if the NIS agents had shown up, and what they came upon was a gentleman in sweatpants, okay, and they knew that the lady of the house was a professional person and worked in an area where one could reasonably be expected to carry a briefcase, the results, appellant's argument would be exactly the same. So again, Your Honor, does it...
Perhaps she was a law student, not on a day in which they were doing interviews.
Yes, and perhaps not on a day when they were having moot court, Your Honor, certainly.
Well, I just want to follow that up a little bit.
Yes, Your Honor.
Your entire case here seems to hinge on the briefcase element. And let's take this situation. Here we know that the law enforcement agents went through the house, went into the bedroom, went into drawers, and presumably if a drawer was locked, they would not have gone into it, but they went into drawers. And if in going into one of those drawers, there was a metal container box, not a briefcase, but just a metal box that was unlocked, and they went into that because they're looking for pictures and everything, would that have been a reasonable search?
Your Honor, I must say I haven't done any research into metal boxes, and I'm not saying that tongue-in-cheek.
Well, let's just say any box that, you know, small box that can fit in a drawer.
If there were indications that a reasonable person would look at that box and say, this box belongs to Gunny Gallagher as opposed to Mrs. Gallagher, then yes.
Well, what evidence is there in this record that this briefcase belonged to the gunnery sergeant, other than your supposition that because he's a gunnery sergeant, it was his briefcase?
It is not just because he was a gunnery sergeant, Your Honor. It is because
What I'm asking you,
okay.
Counsel, is
yes,
what specific evidence can you point to in the record that would have indicated to the law enforcement people in this case that this briefcase belonged to the gunnery sergeant?
On the bare facts of the record, without any further inquiry by the police, by the NIS agents, there may not be any, Your Honor.
And if we disagree with you about this, the briefcase is different, do you lose?
No.
Why not?
Well, for two reasons, Your Honor. First off, when you say, would you disagree with me when I say that briefcases are different, I think that the law is fairly clear that briefcases are different. But we also, we do not lose in the sense of, because there are other cases, and the Foltz case is a perfect example, in which items, not necessarily a briefcase, in that case, it's a cardboard box in a garage. In the Welch case, it is a purse. There are other items that one can own, the duffel bag example that I gave you, that would have led to the same result, which is the police officers come upon the scene and they have no reason to believe. And in fact, there are two circuits, the 9th and the 10th, both say that the burden is not upon the appellant to show that he has the ownership, but is upon the authorities to show that he does not have that ownership. And in fact, the two quotes, I believe it is the Whitfield case and again the Foltz case, which is that the government has the duty, the burden of providing compelling evidence. But the other reason is, at the very least, and whether you adopt Salinas Cano and the amicus position as an overarching position isn't really the issue for the appellant to address, at the very least, under the facts of this particular case, the appellant would argue that the NIS agents had an obligation to go that further step and inquire as to the ownership of the briefcase.
I have a question about the issue of the lock. Is your position that the briefcase was locked or unlocked?
Your Honor, I would answer that question this way, okay? I understand the military judge's findings. I'm not arguing that the military judge's findings are clearly erroneous. Do I have my own personal opinion? I believe that the facts support the fact that the briefcase was locked.
That's throw something at it and hope it sticks.
No, I mean, Judge, I believe the facts do support that it was locked.
Was the military judge's finding clearly erroneous or not?
They're not, Your Honor.
What do you make, if anything, of the government's expert's opinion that the lock was broken on the thing?
I think that that is some evidence that would lead one to believe that the government, that the NIS agents broke the lock. Maybe not enough evidence for this military judge to conclude that.
Did the military judge make a finding of fact that the briefcase was unlocked?
I believe the military judge's finding of fact, Your Honor, was that the agent testified that it was open and that Mrs. Gallagher said that it was always locked.
But what did the military judge reported these interesting bits of testimony? Is there a finding of fact in this case as to whether the briefcase was open or closed, upon which we can then determine, looking at the record, whether it was clearly erroneous or not?
I don't believe that he specifically found one way or another, Your Honor.
Thank you.
But I can certainly check and make sure.
That's fine.
All right. Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you, counsel. Now we'll have counsel for the amicus, Mr. Cusick. And come on up to the podium, but before you speak, we do have a number of open seats here, so if anyone is desirous of sitting, please come. We'll take a break for a second or two so you can fill in the open seats. And no, we're not icing the kicker here. All right, counsel for the amicus, you may begin.
Thank you. Chief Judge Efron, and may it please the court, I'm Captain Matt Kusky, and I appear on behalf of Amicus Curiae George Mason University in support of Appellant Gunnery Sergeant Gallagher. I appear today principally to urge the adoption of a rule of law followed by the Tenth Circuit in United States versus Salinas Cano.
I don't mean to be a troublemaker, but when you say you're a captain, are you here representing a military service, or are you here in your capacity as a student, just to be clear?
I'm sorry, Your Honor. I'm here in my capacity as a student.
I mean, I understand that intrinsically, but since you introduced yourself as a captain, I wanted to make sure I had your identity down.
Yes, Your Honor. This rule of law that I'm suggesting would provide needed clarity to the field of consent-based container searches. It would promote judicial economy, and it would further the community's shared interest in obtaining consent. I will address each of those three concepts in sequence, pending, of course, any questions by the court.
You're simply arguing legal policy here.
Yes, Your Honor.
Not the merits of the case.
Well, we could get into the merits, Your Honor, if you want to take it in that direction. I have some thoughts on the Appellate Defense Counsel position.
Proceed with your argument.
Yes, Your Honor.
Are you conceding that you're arguing legal policy and not law, and therefore this is all discretionary on our part?
No, Your Honor. Part of my argument is a matter of law.
And you'll distinguish between what's law and what's legal policy?
Yes, Your Honor, to the extent I can. As the parties indicate, where one co-occupant authorizes the search of a common residence, the scope of her consent extends only to her own property and that property which a police officer could reasonably believe is subject to mutual use, joint access, and shared control. Problematic cases arise where, as here, during the course of a search, police discover a container that's ambiguous as to mutual use. In United States versus Salinas Cano, the Tenth Circuit addressed this ambiguity in a way that safeguards the government's ability to acquire relevant evidence while at the same time protecting privacy interests under the Fourth Amendment. Under Salinas Cano, where the police wish to open an ambiguous container, they must first seek additional clarification from the consenting co-occupant.
What is an ambiguous container?
Your Honor, it's a container that's neither clearly the private property of one party nor the other, nor is it clearly mutually used property. And so when a police officer is confronted with this type of container, he has to seek additional clarification from the consenting co-occupant before he or
what
she
was the
it.
Ambiguous property in Salinas Cano?
I believe it was a briefcase, Your Honor, but I may be mistaken on that. I'm sorry. I can answer that after
the. Well, you're arguing this case. What are the facts of this case? The facts of Salinas Cano. You're urging this as a matter of legal policy, but we need to know the facts that underlay the Tenth Circuit's decision.
I understand, Your Honor. I'm sorry. I unfortunately was not prepared for that precise question.
Okay, please proceed.
Yes, Your Honor.
Counsel, do you agree with the military judge's conclusion of law number B4 that the NCIS agent possessed no facts that reasonably should have caused him to believe the briefcase was the exclusive domain of the accused? In fact, it would have been just as reasonable for him to conclude the briefcase was primarily used by Mrs. Gallagher?
I would disagree with that entirely, Your Honor. I would say that the police had no information before them from which to draw any reasonable conclusions regarding ownership of the briefcase. A briefcase is a problematic container because in this day and age, there are no gendered norms that allow police to reasonably assign ownership of the briefcase. So for that reason, the amicus position is that in light of the absence of gendered norms to resolve ownership of the briefcase, and given as appellate defense counsel urges, no police officer could reasonably believe this was mutually used property, the
Why
opening
not?
Of the briefcase. Sorry, Your Honor?
Why not? It's sitting there unlocked in a commonly used area of the house in plain sight.
In Georgia versus Randolph, Your Honor, the Supreme Court put us all in the business of applying social custom or customary expectations to construe constitutional law in these situations. Whatever the logic or merit of the use of custom in constitutional
law. Is Georgia v. Randolph controlling here?
To a certain extent it is, Your Honor, at least insofar as the use of custom is concerned. Now, earlier appellate defense counsel quoted Ferrer that the briefcase, few places outside one's home justify a greater expectation of privacy than the briefcase. There, the court wasn't expounding constitutional law. They were making a common sense observation based upon social custom. And then, of course, there's the pocket analogy that appellant's defense counsel raised. So just as you would not tolerate me reaching into your own pockets, for example, you would not tolerate me reaching into your own briefcase.
Now, in Salinas,
Go ahead.
Were you happy with your opportunity to respond?
Go ahead, Your Honor, please.
Okay. In Salinas, if we're dealing with the boyfriend's suitcase at the girlfriend's apartment, and the police know that it's the boyfriend's suitcase, so we don't have the ambiguity, why is this case different, or how would you get this case with the different facts into your Salinas construct?
I'm sorry, I'm not sure I understand
the
question.
The police knew that it was the boyfriend's suitcase. The girlfriend consents to the search. Here, unless you're arguing that the judge had it clearly wrong, they don't know whose briefcase it is.
Yes, Your Honor. And so we have a situation where we have a purely ambiguous container that would be within the control of Salinas Cano, where the police would have to see.
Why is it in the control of that case when in that case the police knew it was the boyfriend's suitcase?
Whatever the facts of Salinas Cano might be, the law in that case that the court was expounding, they were actually following the standard first developed by the D.C. Circuit in United States versus Whitfield, and the triggering event for the Salinas Cano standard to apply is the presence of an ambiguous container.
Now, so, what's your response to the Melgar court that says this just isn't workable? So you're going through, and first you have your debate about which pieces of Tupperware are ambiguous containers and so on, and we can play that game out, going through every container that might be in your house. How can you conduct the search if you got to play what's my container?
Well, the beauty of Salinas Cano, Your Honor, is that it creates an incentive for police officers to more actively involve the consenting co-occupant during the course of a search. So a prudent police officer would drag the consenting co-occupant all over the house. Anytime he or she had a question, she would say, is this yours? Do you use it? May I open it?
What if they don't want the person to see where they're searching? What if the person has a job to go to, say, Blockbuster? Pick a random place.
What if the police don't want the consenting co-occupant to see where they're searching?
Why don't they, I mean, why don't they just say, do we have your consent to look at all ambiguous containers?
Well, I think that would raise an issue of law because under United States versus Matlock and progeny, the police may only open those containers that a reasonable person could believe was subject to the mutual use of the parties. If the police are going behind a screen and opening things, the possibility of governmental abuse there is sort of large. Salinas Cano provides limited protection to a limited class of containers that illuminate a penumbra of intimacy. At the same time, it safeguards the government's ability to acquire relevant evidence.
So you're looking to switch the default over to the other side?
Yes, Your Honor, essentially, but I think, are you addressing the statement the court made in United States versus Melgar about which way the risk will run?
That and the Melgar court's concern about functionality, that if you have to go back and request permission, re-consent to every article, it's a dysfunctional way to perform the search function.
Actually, Your Honor, I don't think that the burden that the government would labor under there would actually be that great. Most houses aren't mansions. It doesn't take a whole lot to have the co-occupant follow you from room to room. But the added time that the government would spend during those sorts of searches would yield later benefits because the odds that a container would be excluded under a mistake of law rationale would be significantly diminished. Under Salinas Cano, there's really only three outcomes that would obtain. The first possibility is the police would seek further clarification. They would obtain it. Then they can just open the container and the evidence comes in. The second possibility is the consenting co-occupant lies and tells the police that she uses the container when in fact she doesn't. That lie converts this situation from a mistake of law to one of mistake of fact. Under Illinois versus Rodriguez, the government gets to keep its evidence. The third possibility is the consenting co-occupant says you can't search it. As unfortunate as that might be for the government, she's merely exercising her constitutional right to refuse a search, which federal courts which can't violate public policy.
Counsel, the traditional standard in Fourth Amendment litigation for searches in this circumstances is reasonableness. And that's worked very well over a number of years. Most courts, both at state and federal level, utilize that. Why won't a reasonableness standard work here?
I'm not urging the abandonment of a reasonableness standard, Your Honor. The problem is Georgia versus Randolph's admonition that we all need to take into account social custom when we're applying our objective test.
No. It seems to me you're asking us to create a new test and go beyond reasonableness and ask law enforcement when they come across a locked container to make further questions, which is not the current status of the law.
Chief Judge Efron, I'm sorry, I'm out of time. May I have
you
a
may,
minute to...
You may answer his question, Judge Urban's question, and I might have one myself as well.
Well, generally speaking, most property inside of a marital home is going to be reasonably presumed to be marital property. So Salinas Cano really only applies to a limited class of containers. So the reasonableness inquiry is still on the table. It's just that there's this wrinkle in the law here that we're adding by forcing the police in situations where they confront an ambiguous container to seek further clarification.
And just very quickly, could you please again define an ambiguous container?
Your Honor, it's a container that's neither the clear property of one party or the other, nor is it clearly mutually used property. So we're talking about purses, briefcases, wallets, and maybe a limited number of other containers.
Cardboard boxes, sacks, plastic sacks, bags.
This is the beauty of Salinas Cano, though. This
laptops.
Is
black trash bags.
I understand the court's point. It's certainly valid, but the beauty of Salinas Cano is it puts the burden of trying to taxonomize these containers on the people who are actually best situated to do so. A police officer is going to err on the side of caution when he comes across your cardboard box, for example, and he's going to say, hey, you, come here. Is this yours? Do you use it? Can I open it? And in that way, if the co-occupant says yes to all of those, the evidence gets to come in. We don't have to, on a case-by-case basis, adjudicate containers by analogy to briefcases and purses and all of that in the future. So it's much more efficient to follow Salinas Cano.
Why not a different standard? And that is, if there is property which is clearly in the possession of one person, but it's ambiguous as to which one. And only in those circumstances would the police be required to get a further articulation of consent. Why not have a standard that, in that case, furthers the concept of reasonableness, respects the judgment of police officials, and only requires this test when something clearly would be in the possession of one person, and the ambiguity is solely as to which one.
There's certainly quite a bit of logic to that, Your Honor. I guess amicus at some level would agree with that principle. I would say, though, that the risk that you run there is there's going to be a number of containers that we have a high expectation of privacy. They literally exude a penumbra of intimacy. And under that standard, the law may fail to recognize that degree of privacy, which, again, has its source in social custom, and we're required to do that analysis by Georgia versus Randolph. I thank the court very much for its time this evening. Amicus, again, respectfully requests for reversal and urges the adoption of United States versus Salinas Cano. Thank you very much.
Thank you, counsel. Counsel for the government.
Good evening, and may it please the court. My name is Major Brian Keller, and along with Colonel Louis Puglio, I represent the government in this case. In a word, with the evidence viewed in the light most favorable to the government, the presumption of control for most purposes arising from a marital relationship and access to the house is not rebutted by any clear showing of exclusive use of the briefcase by appellant. The Supreme Court in Florida v. Jimeno has already rejected appellant's proposed modification of the law that where police wish to search closed containers, they must separately request permission to search each container. They continue in their holding, but if his consent, in this case her consent, would reasonably be understood to extend to a particular container, the Fourth Amendment provides no grounds for requiring a more explicit authorization.
Is yours better argument that she had actual authority or apparent authority?
She clearly had both, Your Honor, in this case.
Asking you to choose which is the stronger argument.
She had actual authority per Clow, Your Honor, and I think appellant ignores the Clow case, the Court of Military Appeals case. And the Clow holding, of course, says, quote, that absent some clear showing, again, the language that I used in the introduction there, that one spouse has exclusive use of some area, a spouse's access should be treated as access to all parts of the marital residence and to the contents of any furniture or containers located therein. An appellant doesn't address Clow, and he doesn't tell this court any reason why that precedent should be overturned. And that's just common sense. I can go to my wife's purse and take out the keys or the cell phone from my wife's purse, and appellant seems to be arguing that that's an area of exclusive control. Appellant tries to cite the Salinas Cano case to say that a briefcase is exclusive, should be treated differently.
Going
of course,
back
that's,
to Judge Ryan's question, and you get to come back to this.
Your Honor.
If you were advising this court and you prevailed, would you advise the court to address the apparent authority or the actual authority question?
Your Honor, it's both. She had actual authority because she was the wife. And as the wife, she's presumed to have access, per Clow, to the entire house. And she certainly gave consent. But she also had apparent authority. If she didn't somehow...
I'm not asking you to concede one half of your argument or the other. I'm asking you whether there's a reason, from the government's perspective, that the field, there's some absence, there's a gap, that the law is anxious for a case on briefcases.
No, Your Honor, Clow addresses this. Clow says that if a wife, if it's a marital relationship, number one, and number two, if that spouse has access to the marital abode, then with regards to all containers located therein, the wife has access, and that's actual authority. She has authority to look in that briefcase. Now, it is possible that he told her behind closed doors, you may never go in my briefcase, you're not allowed to get in there, and in fact, it was a locked briefcase.
Could he have testified as to on the suppression motion?
I'm sorry, Your Honor?
Could the appellant have testified on the suppression motion?
He could have, Your Honor.
Without prejudice to his right to silence?
Yes, Your Honor. So she had actual authority to do it, but if he had behind closed doors told her she could not access the briefcase, that would be apparent authority, and that she would have had, the agents reasonably would have believed that she could consent to a search of the entire house, including the garage, including...
Well, I mean, I think that you need to be fair to appellant, right? Which is, you know, Clow is talking about areas and furniture in the home. It's not specifically talking about purses and briefcases and things that, by their nature, ordinarily belong to one person as opposed to the other. And so I'll ask you again, if we had to decide this case on the basis of actual or apparent authority, which do you believe is the most sustainable basis?
If this court holds that cloud does not apply to containers, as it says that it does, then apparent authority, clearly, Your Honor. That's an easier route to get there. But cloud does say to all containers located therein, and that does seem to extend, as the precedent says right now, to briefcases. That's a container inside a house. And I think appellant ignores that precedent conveniently. And again, I could go inside my wife's purse to get her phone. I could go inside her briefcase to get a laptop.
One of the risks here is that in the military judge talked about going into his wife's purse, and the test here is not whether the military judge in this case has a particular relationship with his wife or what I do in my home, but then this is where the amicus may be onto something. He's trying to find what a normative social custom is. Surely this case doesn't resolve around, I say this respectfully, your relationship with briefcases and other pieces of furniture or whatever with your wife,
of
nor
course.
My wife.
Yes, Your Honor, but that's I'm making that as a statement of what's objectively reasonable, and that is the test here, of course, Fourth Amendment objective reasonableness. Taking the facts in this case in the light most favorable to the government, that's not an erroneous statement to say that it's objectively reasonable to think that she had access to that briefcase. It
based
was a
on
nondescript.
The facts.
On the facts
of
this case,
the
yes, Your Honor. I only say that by way of that's an objective norm, that I could go into my wife's briefcase. Anybody could go into their spouse's briefcase.
Well, as I understand your argument, if we were to apply the language of Clow and not revisit it in light of George against Randolph, then anything that is within the home or other common dominion of the husband and spouse is subject to the spouse's consent unless there's a clear showing of exclusivity. So it's all open. That's the holding of Clow.
Yes, sir.
Nothing that's happened since Clow, including George against Randolph, requires us to revisit it. So even something that is clearly gender specific would still be subject to that common consent unless there was some affirmative showing of exclusivity. That sounds like a situation then in which recognizing that an accused can testify on a motion without the information being used adversely against him or her at trial. Is there any way that a person could demonstrate that other than getting on the stand and testifying short of an email or other letter demonstrating exclusivity? Won't the accused in every case under the standard have to get on the stand and testify?
They could get on the stand and testify, Your Honor.
I'm not asking whether they could. We know that they could. But
yes,
how else would someone show exclusivity in a situation like this?
Yes, Your Honor. Well, they could have ensured that it was clear that this briefcase was locked. In this case, of course, the facts, and I think the facts do, Judge Ryan, indicate on JA 191 to 192 that he opened the briefcase without manipulation. So he put it on the table and it just opened up. So in this case, it was reasonable to think that he thought that it was not locked. But had it been locked and clearly locked, that would be one way to show exclusivity.
Is that a finding of fact by the judge, or is that a fact that's in the record which is not a finding of fact by the judge?
Your Honor, JA 65, one of the agents testified that he pushed the buttons and they flipped open.
I know what the agents testified to, but my question is, our responsibility as an appellate court is to look at the findings of facts and conclusions of law made by the military judge. Is there any finding of fact by the military judge that would tell us that this was or was not locked?
Your Honor, I can only again say 191 and 192, where the judge said the briefcase opened without manipulation. So he didn't use the magic word you're saying, locked, but those facts right there would indicate to the reasonable agent that it was unlocked, that it opened without manipulation.
The military judge found that, you say?
Yes, Your Honor, that's 191 and 192.
The judge found that the right spindle was broken, and that's backed up by the Firearms Division report as well.
Yes, Your Honor.
That could suggest that the thing popped open as well because the right spindle was broken. Is that also something that one might assume?
It could, Your Honor. The test, of course, again, is that the facts taken in the light most favorable to the government, And here, the judge found that they were not manipulated, I believe, so that would indicate that they were not manipulated, taking them in the light most favorable to the government.
Was there any area of this house or any container of this house that the spouse did not consent to search in this case?
Not that I know of, Your Honor. This was a consent to search the entire house for, I believe, the consent form, the pass form said for evidence of indecent liberties with children. And the agent specifically then testified that they told Mrs. Gallagher that it was also, that included videotapes and pictures of the children. And of course, the wife then proactively told the agents, there's the video camera, you're probably gonna want that. She asserted control over the video cassette, the tape boxes, allowed them while she was present.
That's a no, right?
Yes, Your Honor.
Okay. And back to Judge Efron's question, how might, I'm not sure that was fully answered.
Go ahead.
How might someone, in the government's view, express exclusive control or a expectation of privacy within the home?
Well, the easiest way, Your Honor, would be to have a locked area of the home where the spouse is prevented from coming into that area of the home and has no key. If the wife then said, I don't have a key, I can't get into that area of the home, that's a depiction of exclusive control. On the far end of it, of course, there's the case where the husband was living in the basement of the union hall. Now, that could have come out either way under the test of reasonableness. It came out in that case that the court found, despite the fact that the wife had a key and led the police to the locked union hall basement where the husband was living away from the spouse.
It could be done through a verbal expression of privacy as well?
It could, Your Honor. Yes, Your Honor. But if that wasn't, again, related to the agents, then they wouldn't know, and it would be reasonable for them to think not.
Did the military? Go ahead.
But that's apparent authority, not actual authority. It would be reasonable.
Yes, Your Honor. If it was a mistake, because, yes, Your Honor, if she hadn't related that to him, that would be apparent authority. But I think RIF, there's of course a split in the federal circuits in how this is addressed. The Second and the Seventh Circuits and the Tenth Circuit in RIF, which modifies the Salinas, they have different spins of the Matlock test. We do think the government's position is that it is disjunctive. There's an or there. Perhaps RIF isn't the best way to do it, but you have the statement access or control. Control perhaps is a more normative route of looking at it, and certainly that's how Clough seems to interpret it. Clough says the simple fact of marriage plus access to the home, that is not exclusivity demonstrated, but she still has access to the home, that demonstrates that there is authority to then search through the house.
Does it make a difference that the military judge in his findings of fact indicated that she had never gone into his briefcase?
It does not, Your Honor. That was testimony that Mrs. Gallagher made during trial, I believe on the motion, and she did indicate after the briefcase was already opened and the child pornography was found, she indicated that it was not her briefcase. I believe maybe that she hadn't gone into it. But that was post facto. Again, that was after the search and after the cat was out of the bag. So, no, Your Honor, it doesn't make any difference that she indicated that on the record. The agents reasonably believe that she had...
On page 8 and 9 of your brief, you note the military judge found it would have been just as reasonable for the government agent to conclude that the briefcase was primarily used by Mrs. Gallagher.
Yes,
which,
Your Honor.
Which aspect of the judge's findings are you relying on? Findings of fact or conclusions of law for that?
He actually makes that finding, Your Honor. If I may have a second to look through the record, Your Honor. I think that's Appellate Exhibit 30 at 12. I'm sorry, I don't have the joint appendix.
He had no facts which should have caused him to believe the briefcase was the exclusive domain of the accused. I read that, and perhaps incorrectly, as referring to the statements that the judge is making previously. And then he says, reasonable for him to conclude that the briefcase was primarily used by Mrs. Gallagher. And then he makes that finding. What is that finding based on? It would have been just as reasonable for him to conclude the briefcase was primarily used by Mrs. Gallagher. Is that based on the social custom discussion we've been having, or is there anything specifically in the record that the judge was relying on for making that finding?
Well, before? I'm not sure there's anything specifically in the record. Well, there is plenty in the record, Your Honor, and that is that it's nondescript, that there was no name on the briefcase, that apparently it was unlocked, that it was sitting in a nondescript portion of the house in the family room, essentially. One of the agents had said that he had seen Mrs. Gallagher smoking and saw the wet bar and assumed that the garage was a place where she hung out and that she relaxed. They knew that it was a family room, a place where the family entertained. So I think the judge's the conclusion is that it would have been just as reasonable to conclude that it was primarily used by her is based on those facts, the fact that it was nondescript, and moreover, sitting between the freezer and the refrigerator, so not as if it was about to be taken out to work. But again, anybody could have owned the briefcase. It could have been a lance corporal, a private, a stay-at-home mom. It wouldn't matter who it is. In this case, it was reasonable for them to believe that it would have been just as reasonable for them to believe that it was her. So again, I think it could have been actual authority. It could have been apparent authority in this case. But it's reasonable to take from the Clow decision actual authority, and I think that should be the decision. In the Rith case, again, they look at this normative analysis. There are some cases where there might be either a normative presumption, which perhaps factors into the widely held social expectations, or there may be simply a factor which has more bearing, certainly the husband-wife situation or a parent and child situation might give rise to the presumption that they have joint access to all areas, and that's that should be one way that Clow is prolonged to the present, Your Honor.
In analyzing the case in terms of the reasonableness of the actions of law enforcement officials, do we look at any testimony about what happened after the briefcase was opened? Does that have any bearing on this, that is, what the police may or may not have learned after it was opened? For example, there seems to be some indication at that point she indicated that it was the appellant's briefcase. Or do we cut it off at the point that the opening was done, that is, and look only at what the police knew at the time they made the particular search?
For the analysis of actual authority, Your Honor, the cutoff at the time the opening was made. For apparent authority, it would be anything that occurred afterwards. And I think the Fraser v. Cup case, where afterwards the appellant said that there was no authority to look in the duffel bags, but of course at the time the agents reasonably believed there was authority to look in the duffel bags. The Rodriguez case goes the other direction. The Clow case also supports that, where the husband didn't actually occupy the room. It had been 5 months since he'd been in the room, but the police reasonably believed that it was okay. So it cuts off at the time of opening, Your Honor. In fine, Your Honor, the government's position is that appellant ignores Clow, and that is still good law and does apply to this case, that there is some kind of norm. There's some kind of normative analysis per the Georgia v. Randolph's widely held social expectations that arises in husband-wife situations. The Salinas case does not support, the government believes, appellant's contention. In Salinas, of course, they say that there's a higher expectation of privacy in some cases like suitcases, which is at its most intense when they're deposited temporarily in places under the general control of another. That's not this case. This is the wife's house. She says you may search the entire house, and it's not there, as far as the agents know, temporarily. This is a marital abode, and again, it's unlike the boyfriend-girlfriend situation of Salinas Cano. The appellant asked this court to find the inverse of the actual rule, that absent evidence of non-exclusivity, exclusivity must be disproven. This is an unreasonable superstructure that Jimeno refused to create. This court should not require a cascade of piecemeal consents prior to searching each container that might possibly have a sole owner. Extant precedent in Clow gives the appropriate test. Where the evidence doesn't clearly establish exclusive control by another, the consenter doesn't limit consent, then the Clow rule obtains. Viewing the evidence in the light most favorable to the government, nothing indicates that Mrs. Gallagher denied authority to open the briefcase, number one, and number two, appellant took no steps to delineate the briefcase was exclusively his own, I'm sorry, Your Honor. If there are no further questions, that ends the government's argument.
Thank you, counsel. Does the defense have rebuttal?
We do, Your Honor.
Your Honor, let me start where the government counsel says we have not tread, which is the case of United States versus Clow. And I would make several observations with regards to Clow. Clearly, Clow has been, by operation of Georgia v. Randolph, the finding in Clow is no longer as solid and maybe as it was. But also, Clow is simply so factually distinguished from the case at bar. And Clow, as you'll recall, the facts were that the wife The husband hadn't lived in the home for a while, was sort of living there sporadically. The wife, upon the request to come in, not only walks them through the house, as Ms. Gallagher did, but literally walks them to the piece of furniture that they wanted to search and opens it up and says, here's the stuff you're looking for. Clearly, those are not the facts of the case at bar.
Counsel, I understand the government's argument, it is not only relying on the facts of Clough, but also the analysis of Clough, and that is my recollection is the phrase, a clear showing of exclusivity. Now, even after George against Randolph, and even in light of Salinas, why shouldn't we apply that standard here, a clear showing of exclusivity before there's a requirement on the part of the police? That is, even if you don't show that it's exclusively in one person or another, you'd have to have a showing that this is the type of property which would be under the control of one.
Because legally, that is no longer the standard, according to by Georgia v. Randolph. But in addition, Your Honor,
what language in Georgia versus Randolph are you relying on specifically to say that the Fourth Amendment standard has changed? I mean, the facts in Georgia versus Randolph were one person said you can come in and search the house, with the other one saying no, you can't.
Right, and Your Honor, if you applied the language of the Clough case, theoretically. If you looked at the exact wording of the Clough case, that standard would have to still apply, according to the government, in light of the facts. So in other words, if they showed up and the husband had been there and said, you can't go in that trunk because that's my personal stuff, according to the government counsel, that wouldn't matter. Well, of course it would matter. Subsequent case law, the Georgia v. Randolph case, has said that broad discussion of exclusive or of the scope of the search enunciated in Clough is no longer the law.
Well, I mean, I understand that, and I'm not sure that the government is going that far in its argument, but what we don't have here is a situation where appellant showed up and told the police, no, you can't search the house.
That is clearly true, Your Honor.
So how exactly does Georgia versus Randolph apply to the facts of this case?
Oh, I'm not saying,
I'm mystified.
I'm not saying that it applies to the facts of this case in that particular sense, Your Honor. I mean, it certainly does apply to the facts of this case as it relates to third-party consent, and there is some language in Georgia v. Randolph that is helpful. But what I'm saying, Your Honor, is that the government wants this court to believe that Clough is still, on its face, black-letter law, and it clearly is not in light of Georgia v. Randolph. But even if this court concludes that it is, the expansive language of Clough, as it relates to exclusive use of some area within the court, within the house, and they were talking about furniture, containers, furniture, that sort of thing, clearly does not relate to the briefcase that is at issue in the case at bar. And then, Your Honors, I would just very briefly, before my time expires, like to point, Judge Efron, you asked me a question as I was leaving the first time around about the findings of fact, and I would point this court that the court specifically said, the military judge specifically concluded that as it relates to the lock, what he said was that it popped open, and he reiterated the testimony of the special agents. The military judge did not make a specific finding of fact one way or another as to whether or not the briefcase was locked, and I wanted to clear that up for the chief judge before I concluded my presentation. Subject to any further questions from the court, that concludes the appellant's presentation. Thank you, members of the court.
Thank you, counsel, and we thank counsel for both parties for your presentation this evening. We also thank counsel for the amicus for your assistance to the court in addressing this case. When the clerk of court adjourns the court, following that, the judges will remain in place in an informal session to conduct a question and answer session for the court. The case is now submitted and the court may be recessed.
All rise. The court stands adjourned until further order of the court. Please be seated.